You have likely seen or fallen prey to what I like to call planty fake news or plant care myths if you have spent any time in the plant community on any form of social media. They come in the form of foolproof hacks that seem just too good to be true, old wives' tales that have been translated just one too many times and don't really make sense anymore, or just stuff that is plain confusing when you are starting out on your plant parenthood journey. When I started my journey from plant killer to plant lady, I fell prey to a lot of this stuff. And this podcast is a testament and a record of all the trends and trials of my plant parenthood journey. I'm lucky to now have a plant friend and horticulturist and plant expert, Leslie Halleck, to turn to when I see something suspect on the internet or I'm not sure if I should try some sort of method I read about. So I thought that I would bring Leslie and my offline internal text thread about various trends I'm seeing to the podcast feed this week and bust a couple of plant care hacks and myths that we've both seen circulating and want to speak out against. Also, Leslie and I have been keeping a rather large secret from you guys for what feels like a year. I am so thrilled to finally be telling you about the launch of the Bloom and Grow Garden Society, the insider tier of the Garden Party platform that is rooted in high-level plant care education and growth. It is going to be your one-stop shop for plant parenthood development, and we are sharing all of the details later in the episode after the plant care myth busting, so stay tuned and welcome. We will be busting myths and revealing secrets on today's episode 137 of
Bloom and Grow Radio.
Leslie, welcome to the most exciting interview for Bloom and Grow Radio that you've done yet.
This has been how many years in the making? Maybe two, three. How long have we been working up to this, Maria?
I know. I guess several years if you think about, you know, us developing our friendship and professional relationship, but also when you think about how many months behind the scenes we've been putting together this exciting launch that we're about to finally announce to everyone. Leslie, I'm so excited to have you on the show today for two different reasons. Number one, we are addressing three commonly known planty fake news, plant myths that you're going to be busting for us with your horticultural background and knowledge. But Leslie, we finally get to announce the Garden Society, our baby that we've been working on behind the scenes for almost a year now. I'm so excited.
It's our big secret. I'm so excited we finally get to talk about it. We've been working so hard and have been so committed to bringing something into the plant and gardening space that does not currently exist.
Like, so, it doesn't exist. It doesn't even exist. You know, and we made it.
We did. YouTube classes, one-off courses are going to have nothing on this, on the Garden Society.
Yes, on the Garden Society. So plant friends, we are finally able to clue you in. So here's the scoop. Leslie and I are working together and have created the one-stop shop for plant parenthood development for you. It's called the Bloom and Grow Garden Society, and it lives within the Bloom and Grow Garden Party platform. So you've already heard me wax poetic and talk about all the exciting things that are happening in the Bloom and Grow Garden Party platform and app. It's an online virtual platform that has an app that connects our community across the world and connects them regionally as well. And it's been a total party and a lot of fun. But my overall larger goal has been to create a place where our community can get together and grow on a much more deeper, intentional way than I could ever create and foster in like a 1 hour podcast or in an Instagram post. And that has always been the Bloom and Grow Garden Society. And way back when, you know, garden societies used to be a thing where people would get together in some sort of public space and have a lecturer and learn about different aspects of plant care, you know, in the 70s and 80s, and they kind of fell out of style. And so we're kind of reviving the Garden Society model of deep education and community connection, but in a virtual way. And I'm so excited to announce that Leslie has agreed to be the horticulturist in residence of the Bloom and Grow Garden Society and is working on all of our educational content. So thanks, Leslie, for embarking on this crazy journey with me.
Well, I think you and I, from the moment we met on my first episode, hit it off and have been thinking, how do we figure out how to work together? Because yep, we're just such the perfect bookends, I think, with your enthusiasm and community building and plant wellness and me bringing the horticulture to the table. We're the perfect pairing, I think, and team to bring to your listeners and a ton of people who've never even heard you before, because we're going to reach a really big audience with the Garden Society. And yeah, we called it the Garden Society because I also felt like there is this really deep desire for deeper learning in the plant space, whether it's outdoor gardening or indoor plants, and in conjunction with community. And that's what the old school plant societies, which are of course still around, but sort of fell out of fashion, I think, you know, in the 90s up until now, but with the resurgence of interest in plants, again, I think that there's a real opportunity to create a very rich, robust experience in this virtual garden society that we've created that is going to give you direct access to deep education and learning in the plant science and horticulture space, right along with building that community and plant friends. And I'm really excited to even grow beyond our initial offerings in the Garden Society to all of the things that are going to manifest from all of these people coming together and all of us learning together. I think I'm so excited. It's going to be so fun.
Hell yeah. It's going to be amazing. So Leslie and I are going to wait till the end of the episode to deep dive into exactly what you'll get in the Garden Society, because we want to do what we do best, which is deliver you high quality education. And that's what we're going to do with these plant myths. But just so you know, if and when you join the Garden Society, you're going to be getting monthly exclusive horticulturist-led education and lectures, opportunities to work with Leslie 101, and opportunities to explore the plant-person connection and planty wellness with me. Right now, we are launching. There is a week-long launch for our founding members of the Garden Society where we're offering 25% off. You'll never see deals this low again. So you can click the link in the show notes to learn more. But Leslie, I kind of want to dive into these planty myths that we got to bust. Okay, Leslie, planty fake news. Let's dive in, because you and I have had so many conversations where I'll text you a video of like 6 plant hacks that you have to try on your plants and being like, hey, Leslie, do any of these work? And your answer is always no, or maybe in the right scenario, but it's being billed as this is like a foolproof hack for all your plants. So as a way to kind of showcase the higher level education you're going to provide in the Garden Society, we thought it would be fun to bust a few plant myths for people today.
Yes, I can't count the number of videos that get forwarded to me or texts that I get, or, you know, can I cut this long stem red rose and stick it in a potato and, you know, grow a rose bush? I mean, it's to the point of ridiculousness. And obviously it would be more than a full-time job for me to, as a professional horticulturist, to try to deal with that kind of information on social media. So, you know, most of the time I just have to roll my eyes and look away, you know, because it's all that I can do. But yes, you will send me those questions and you can usually count on my answer being no. Or like you said, well, it's possible that it could work under certain circumstances for certain plants, given the right conditions, if you understand the science behind, right, what's happening in that video. The problem is that you have non-qualified, right, individuals putting out this information without really understanding what's going on behind the science. And like you said, billing it as foolproof tips, tricks, and hacks for getting plants to do essentially some things that they're just not ever going to do, or using things that really are going to have no beneficial impact on your plants at all. And so there's a lot of that out there. Occasionally, some of those myths may have some logical applications, or there might be some reality behind them, but it always comes with a caveat. Like, it depends.
Totally, totally. And I want to say too, before we dive into the planty fake news, I want to own the fact that in my 4 years of growing the podcast and growing as a plant parent, I've definitely fell prey to a lot of the plant myths. You know, I used to sing misting's praises on the top of mountaintops, and I used to mist my plants, and I used to do a lot of these hacks because I believed everything I read on the internet was true. And it's a huge reason why I've launched the Garden Society, to help people kind of leapfrog over that phase of plant parenthood where you don't know enough to know better. So why don't we dive into probably the most famous planty fake news myth first, let's bust the myth of the fact that everyone says that houseplants clean your air and you can have one houseplant in your room. And I really want plants that filter my air in my bedroom. Or had people say, you know, I want to decorate the nursery and put a houseplant in the nursery because it cleans the air for the baby, or all of these things. And I cringe because I'm like, oh boy, that's not entirely true. But I feel like a lot of people have marketed plants in this kind of capacity. So take it away.
Yeah, I think everyone, myself included, we're all guilty at some point or another at regurgitating something that seems logical to us. And when it comes to plant science research, you know, the more research gets done, the more we find out. And sometimes the thing we thought was true isn't as true as we thought it was, or we find the more specific biochemical or molecular processes that's controlling things. And we go, oh, okay, that's not what is happening. Something else is happening. But that takes research and science. The whole plants purifying your air thing is such effective clickbait these days, because it's something that seems logical and it's something we so very much want to be 100% true. I cannot count the number of bloggers, writers, journalists that contact me wanting quotes about air purifying plants. And you can probably go back 15 years and find something on the internet where I was like, yeah, sure, these plants, you know, help you with your air quality because they do produce oxygen. But, you know, and unfortunately, when I tell these reporters and people looking for quotes that, well, this is not really accurate, and I go on to explain, I never hear back from them. They don't then want to include me. They don't want to use my quotes because I'm not reinforcing the thing they want to regurgitate for clickbait. That's a big issue.
Totally. And I think this all stems from this NASA study that was done in the 80s. And because it was a study by NASA, everybody quotes it as studies show that these plants clean this air, blah, blah, blah. But I think what people don't realize is how isolated and how specific that study was and how different those conditions were. And I know we've talked about it a little bit on the podcast before, but do you kind of want to dive into why it's a little bit true, but not totally true?
Yeah, actually the research that gets quoted, and even, you know, you can pull up articles written yesterday, you know, and they will use this particular research as the citation for their blog or their article. And it actually started in, I believe, 1973, if I'm not mistaken. The paper that they published from this work, Bill Wolverton, I believe, was in 89. So you can find the paper that was actually put out in 89 on the research that got started in the 70s, specifically to address the hypothesis that plants could filter VOCs, or volatile organic chemicals, out of the air in tightly controlled environments, And one of the reasons why this research came about was because in the world of building and architecture, we have to make things more efficient, right? In order to reduce cooling costs, we need to make buildings tighter, right? We need to sort of reduce the passive air exchange. So as building materials became quote unquote better in terms of keeping in heat or keeping in cool, more materials were being used that were putting off VOCs. And as the buildings became tighter with less passive air exchange, we started to see things that were labeled as sick building syndrome. You know, people having negative health reactions to being in these closed up buildings. And so this research was sort of looking at, hey, how can we combat sick building syndrome? You know, as buildings become more efficient, people inside might get sicker because of air quality issues. Could plants be a solution to this, right? Because plants, right, through the process of photosynthesis, right, we know that plants use water and carbon dioxide to produce oxygen through the process of photosynthesis, right? They pull carbon dioxide out of the air and a little bit at the root zone. They also use water using light radiant energy. The process of photosynthesis is able to happen, and plants then convert those things into food, right? Absorbed by the chlorophyll and convert that into food. And a byproduct of that in breaking up those water molecules is the release of oxygen, of O2, back into the atmosphere. But releasing oxygen into the atmosphere, and it isn't purifying your air, right? It's good that plants are making oxygen. Although I will, as an aside, note to you that about 70% of the oxygen that we get from our environment actually comes from the ocean. comes from phytoplankton and algae. So while trees and plants obviously are producing a lot of our oxygen, we really have the ocean, flora and fauna to thank for that. But that's an aside. But anyway, so yes, plants of course produce oxygen, but can they then absorb potentially all those VOCs, things like formaldehyde or toluene or benzene, trichloroethylene, and then of course, you know, carbon dioxide, which at higher concentrations is not a good thing for us. So they built what they called a biohome, and it was a 650 square foot enclosed building with recycled air. I think the living area for the person was about 325 square feet. So we're looking at a small space. It included plants, it included air filtration systems, and then they tested by injecting the space with individual VOCs, you know, to see how well those things were pulled out. So when you read the actual paper that came out in 89 and you read the summary of that paper, the researchers themselves tell you in that paper, hey, plants themselves are not going to do this job. Yes, they produce some oxygen. You know, we can talk about some of the ways that plants can attach or absorb VOCs, but they're going to tell you in this building that in order to really clean the air in an enclosed typical home or office building, you need to combine plants with an air filtration system and fans. That a passive plant growing system, which is what we do in houseplants. We have a plant, we have a growing media, and we have a container, right? That's passive. We're not doing anything to sort of move the air through a filtration system. Isn't going to do the job. You have to combine plants with filtration systems, right? And air movement. And interestingly enough, if you do some digging online, you'll find that Dr. Wolverson, who was involved in this research, went on to develop products that did just those things. A pot that holds a plant that has a fan and a filtration system in it to help you filter the air. So the reality is that houseplants in your space are not going to purify your air. I think that that's an irresponsible misuse of semantics, because there's a lot more that goes into truly purifying your air of VOCs in an indoor space besides having some houseplants.
Let's talk about the scale of it all, because most people think, okay, I'll go to the plant shop and I'll buy two plants, and that's going to be enough to filter my entire living room. Or even if I'm a real enthusiast, maybe I have 50 or 60 plants, they're going to think that that's enough. But there have been studies that have kind of shown, I believe, I always get it wrong, but is it 10 plants per square foot or...
Well, I'm going to make things worse for you.
Okay, go for it.
So if you dig into the scientific research, you will also find a paper that came out in 2019 by some researchers that basically looked at this very issue, and they pulled 12 studies, right, that focus on this particular topic. And they analyzed all the data and they sort of plugged that into sort of purification quantification standards to see kind of what we were really getting. And they basically said, yeah, this isn't doing any good. It's going to take up to 1,000 potted plants per square meter to remove all the different types of VOCs that you typically are going to have in your indoor air. In my class, I'll be throwing up a picture of the conservatory at Longwood Gardens, which is just to die for. And if I could live inside the conservatory of Longwood Gardens, I would, because it's glorious. Or if you live in a rainforest, if you are literally surrounded in a closed environment with that many plants, then we can talk.
Right.
But the reality is that you probably are never going to be able to have enough plants in a standard home or apartment to do truly what we mean is purifying your air and removing all those VOCs. Now, I can walk through with you some of the things potentially they can do. And I think sort of general recommendations are, look, if you want to add a little bit of oxygen to your air and maybe trap some VOCs, obviously, we can't quantify that for each individual home environment. You want to have at least two good sized, so larger plant, larger leaf surface area per 100 square feet of interior space. Is that going to quote unquote purify your home air? No. But we can talk about some of the things that can happen with plants and VOCs. And then I can talk about some of the other benefits that we know we get from plants that have been shown scientifically to help us.
you have upcoming travel to a different country scheduled, or maybe you have a relative or a friend who speaks a different language that you want to connect with on a deeper level, why not easily learn a new language with my favorite language learning tool, Rosetta Stone? I recently went to Italy and I brushed up on my Italian by using the Rosetta Stone app for like 20 minutes every morning. It was so easy to use. It was part of my morning practice. It was really fun. And let me tell you, Rosetta Stone works. It brushed me up so good. I was getting around Italy easily speaking Italian after putting those reps in. If you don't already know, Rosetta Stone is the trusted language learning tool available on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone has 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages offered. It makes language learning so fun, so easy, and so fast. It immerses you in the language, which is the fastest way to learn. So it's an intuitive process with no English translation, so you really learn to speak, listen, and think in the language. It even coaches you on pronunciation with its true accent feature, which is like basically having a physical trainer for your accent. It's so wild. The desktop and app options make it so easy to do consistently, and it's an amazing value. Lifetime membership has all 25 languages forever for any and all trips and language needs in your entire life. So this year I brushed up on my Italian, but next year Billy and I want to go to Japan so we could learn conversational Japanese with it. That's lifetime access to 25 language courses Rosetta Stone has to offer, and right now they're offering 50% off. It's an insane steal. So don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, Growing Joy with Plants listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life, plant friends. It's an insane deal. Redeem 50% off at Rosetta, R-O-S-E-T-T-A, stone.com/today. For sure. Let's turn this into a little positive moment.
Sure.
Because I think too, what you're about to dive into, unless there's a fungal thing or there's something bad, like they're not going to make the air quality worse, but they're— Right. There's always a but, because
So as someone who has a lot of allergies, right, and has had for most of my life, my allergists all my life have said no plants inside, no pets, which of course I completely ignore all of that. Let me give you a few more of the potential negatives and then we'll dive into the positives.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
the reality is that, and there needs to be a lot more research done on this. So understand that as we get more scientific research on this, we will learn more and we will be able to quantify these things better. But there is a reality that you could have secondary gas pollutants emitted by plants. So you could be trading one negative for another. There could be negative outputs from the microbiome or the rhizosphere, right, in the soil or the growing media. You can have mold, mildew growing in that, which that's my number one allergy, which is why I'm not supposed to have houseplants. That's an issue, especially, you know, if you're doing a lot of watering or you were, like you said, doing a lot of misting and potentially increasing the opportunities for mildew growth, right, in your, you know, in the floors or carpets or whatever. So yes, you could potentially, given your personal physiology, make things worse for yourself. It really just depends. So the things that we know plants can do in terms of quote unquote air purification. Okay. We know that plants can remove some VOCs. Okay. And there's a few different ways they can do this. Some volatile organic chemicals can get trapped on the leaf cuticle, right? That waxy lipid layer on the leaf surface can actually just physically trap certain molecules of VOCs. Some VOCs can actually be absorbed through the stomata of the leaf, okay? And enzymes within the plant can break up some of those molecules. Plant roots can absorb. The soil in the growing media, the rhizosphere, that actually from research looks to be maybe even more potentially powerful as a filter for VOCs than the plant leaves per se. And then you've got microbes that potentially exist in the growing media that could be metabolizing, could be absorbing and metabolizing certain VOCs. So these things are certainly true. And I think as more research is done, we'll get a better idea of how much and what plants can actually do. And I would assume that's going to be species specific, right? Because different species are going to have the ability, depending on their natural environment and how they've evolved, to do different things better, you know, than other plants. You know, some plants produce more oxygen, right, than other plants, just based on their metabolism and how efficient they are. So certainly oxygen generation is a positive benefit that you get. But certainly putting a couple of plants in your bedroom is not going to mean that you breathe better or not because of them producing oxygen. So there are some potential negatives, but let's talk about some of the positive things that we know. While the clickbait of all of these plants are going to totally purify your air may not be true, we do know that plants have a positive psychological value for us, right? We do know that they improve your mood. They can reduce fatigue. They can help lower stress and anxiety. They can help improve productivity, so your office and work performance, and they can help boost healing and pain tolerance, the rate at which you heal. We know that these positive effects happen. From a physical standpoint, right, we know that when you group plants together, you can potentially raise humidity, right, through transpiration, and you can cool temperatures. So if you want to naturally cool your space a little bit, right, plants can do that. They can also buffer noise. And I don't think a lot of people realize this or think about it. They're a noise buffer. So having more plants in your space can help you cut down on sort of, you know, outdoor ambient noise that is bothersome to you. So, and like I mentioned, they do have different systems for filtering VOCs. We just need more research to figure out exactly what those are.
And they just look so cute. They make your home look cute and aesthetically pleasing.
Of course. There is, of course, an aesthetic, visual, natural vibe. We all want to be surrounded by nature. Yeah. And so I think that if you've got a good air filtration system in your house, mm-hmm. and you combine houseplants with a good air filter, that's going to have a positive effect for you.
The other thing about this myth busting is we're not trying to be negative. We're not trying to yuck anybody's yums, but like this information is important for everyone to know so that they can make their choices on plant purchasing and how many plants they want in their home and all of these things. Like knowledge is power just in terms of like being able to make the decisions for yourself, you know, not being led by this false pretense of I need to have these plants in order to purify my home when that's really not what they're doing. But they can give you so many other fabulous benefits. And I think you and I are both still saying, hey, like everybody should have plants in their home, but you should just make sure you're having them for the right reasons.
I'm always a big fan of managing expectations and sort of being realistic about things. And so there's just so much of this regurgitated and shared that I think it's worth looking at the actual science and taking a step back and saying, okay, what's really going on here? Because, you know, saying a few houseplants are going to purify the air in your home is just not true and it's not realistic. And I don't think people should be selling plants to you based on that exaggerated expectation, but there are plenty of other great reasons to sell them to you.
Absolutely. So now I'm really excited about myth number two that we're going to bust, because until I took some higher level educational courses, did not really grasp the reason behind this myth busting, which is you don't necessarily pot up your plants every 2 years. I feel like that's a very standard recommendation given. Every blog you read says pot your plant up every 1 or 2 years and always go up 2 inches, like the size of a 2-inch pot. So don't over pot it, but there's some sort of expectation that you should be bumping your plant up a pot size every couple of years. And through my class with you, I've learned that that's actually not the case and something that can be actually detrimental to plants. So why don't you take it away? Because this one was a big one for me.
Yeah, you see on so many sites, sort of the general recommendation, repot your plants every 12 to 24 months, repot your plant after you bring it home from the garden center, right? Repot your plant. There's sort of a general schedule that gets put out as a recommendation with your houseplants. And, you know, one of the things I know that you learned in being in some of my classes that I think always drives my students crazy, but it is the truth, is I'm going to say it depends a whole lot. There isn't a rule. Now, you know, I do feel like learning the science of plant physiology and botany, how plants work and why, you need to learn that so that you can learn when and how to bend those rules given your own individual circumstance. So what I do want to say on this topic is there is no hard rule to repotting. So when you are told, when you bring that plant home or you get it in the mail that you need to repot it and you need to repot it into a pot that's 2 inches larger, you could be well on your way to killing that plant, right? Or overwatering it or underwatering it. So there are a few reasons why you put a plant into a pot with growing media. You need to anchor the plant, right? That's what growing media is for. Growing media or soil out in the natural world is there to anchor the plant's root system. It's there to give roots air, water, and nutrients. And you need enough space in a containerized environment to allow for the maximum necessary root growth in this environment, right? But not too much. Mm-hmm. So those are your three primary reasons for potting up your plant and why and how you do it. When it comes to repotting, you need to do it when the plant needs it, not when your schedule says it's time to do it. Mm-hmm. So, and it's species specific. And I think the more you become a plant collector and the more different type of species you grow, you start to realize, boy, there's a big variation in how I'm going to pot. And in fact, I think you know this, one of the recommendations I often give more than any else is to pot down. And we can talk about that in a minute, but everyone's so focused on bumping up. And when I say bumping, that's an industry term, bumping up. You know, you basically take that plant and you repot it into a larger container with more growing media. But as you and I know, that's not always going to be beneficial for a plant. So we can kind of go through the list if you want of sort of the reasons why.
Yes, let's do it.
And when. So there's a few different reasons why you would want to bump a plant up to a larger container, right? There is no seasonal schedule. It's not like in spring, you know, your plants are going to say, I'm ready for a larger pot. It's all about that species when their active growing period is and how vigorous that species is and what size pot they're in to start with. So if you've got roots growing out of the pot or the drainage holes or up and over the side, and it's not an aerial rooting plant, if that plant is pushing itself up, that's heaving. In the outdoor environment, we call that heaving. It's pushing itself up out of the pot because there's so much root growth. And potentially it has stunted and stopped growing because it can't, there's really not enough growing media left or airspace for the plant to thrive. It's getting top heavy and falling over because of that. It's drying out constantly. Like you're watering it every day and it's just not absorbing anything. Those are really obvious reasons why you're ready to repot. You may also have salt and mineral buildup on the surface of your soil. You know, if you're using synthetic plant fertilizers regularly, those are soluble salts, or your tap water, you know, has salts in them, and that buildup can be toxic to your plant. So your growing media may need to be cleaned up and refreshed because you've got too much salt buildup. Okay. That's a reason to repot. Now you might repot that plant with fresh growing media without going to a bigger pot. You know, conversely,
can we talk about that for a minute?
Yes.
Because I feel like some people don't understand that a soil refresh is an option instead of just potting up. Can you talk to when the soil refresh is the better move?
Yeah. So I always encourage doing a deeper dive of learning and research into the plant species you're growing. It's too easy to assume that all the plants you're growing have the same kind of root system and need the same type of environment, or the same type of growing media, or the same type of even container, be it porous or sealed, right? Mm-hmm. So if your plant has been growing in the same pot for a few years with the same growing media, and it's otherwise fine, you know, the root growth is fine, the plant is fine, it's not outgrowing its space, but you see that salt buildup heavily building up on top of the surface of the soil, that's an indicator to you that it's probably time to take out that plant, remove a good amount of that growing media, especially the top couple of inches where that salt tends to build up. Use new fresh potting mix, but pot it back into the same pot. If you take let's say an African violet, okay, that has a relatively delicate small root system, and you just keep potting it up into a bigger pot, you're going to rot it. So depending on the species and the structure of its root system, you may need to stay in the same size pot, or you may need to go smaller. So refreshing your growing media, normally for indoor plants, we're talking about using more of an inert media, meaning you don't necessarily have a lot of organic matter. I usually say, you know, around 10% organic matter in your growing media is adequate. Otherwise, you can start to have some issues. By that point in time, the organic matter is probably depleted in your potting mix and you've got salts buildup. So it's time to freshen up the potting mix. But I think the natural impetus is to say, okay, well, now I have to go up to a bigger pot. You don't have to do that. It depends on the species. Now, if the plant is doing those other things I just listed, it's getting huge. The roots are pushing the plant out of the pot. You've got roots growing out of the bottom of the pot. That's a signal to you that that plant needs to expand its root system and there's not enough room to do that. And at that point, going up 2 to 4 inches in diameter on the pot, depending on the species, would be warranted.
Got it. Yeah, I've definitely potted up. I actually think I did pot up an African violet too large and not understand that that excess potting media that we're repotting in that has no roots to uptake anything from is just going to sit there and it's going to remain damp longer than it would have remained if it was in the smaller pot. And that's actually going to cause root rot, maybe fungal issues as well.
That's another reason that you might repot. Okay, that has nothing to do with season or schedule. So you may have a plant that has some root decay. Maybe this plant was growing in a container that didn't have a drainage hole for a while and it started to show some signs of stress, and you pull that plant out and you say, ooh, I've got a lot of brown, mushy roots and decay from these roots suffocating. So you may need to then prune away, you know, that decayed root tissue, get fresh potting mix. Now that plant has what? After you've pruned off half of its dead root system, a much smaller root system, what do you think is going to happen if you go into a bigger pot, right? You're going to have overwatering issues. You're potentially going to still have a rot issue. So potting down to a smaller size can be helpful. And I see this with a lot of plant problems that people bring to me with their house plants. They're overwatering. Generally, number one is a condition of light being too low. You know, you'll hear me say this all the time. Mm-hmm. Or the pot is too big and it's holding too much moisture. So pot it down. And that seems to be an epiphany for a lot of people, you know, depending on the species. Like, oh, I thought I needed a bigger pot. But in reality, this species is going to do better. You know, a lot of epiphytes that may, or semi-epiphytes that may not have really large terrestrial root systems. Monstera deliciosa is a great example. It's a big plant that doesn't necessarily need a relatively huge pot. You'll overwater that root zone, right? Mm-hmm. So you may also have, like, maybe you've got root mealybugs. You may have a pest infestation. Maybe you're overrun with fungus gnats in that growing media and it's time to refresh it, or you've got root mealybugs and you need to treat that and replace that growing media. So, or, you know, if you want to get aesthetic about it, maybe your pot is just really, really unattractive and it's time to put a new pot. You want a new pot? That's fine. So there are a lot of reasons for the size of the root system, whether it's ready to expand or maybe it's too small. You want to make sure that the pot is going to hold the right amount of growing media for that size root system and for the condition of that plant so that you can better manage the water. There are many plants that grow year round, and essentially you can just repot them anytime they need to be repotted. Ideally, you're looking to get new root growth, right? Sooner rather than later, so you don't overwater. So that is why you'll get a lot of the recommendations to repot right before spring, because spring is an active growing season for many plants. But if you've got a plant that's in distress that clearly needs to be potted up, or potted down, or it's gonna croak, then what good is waiting till spring going to do you?
Thank you, Espoma Organic, for sponsoring today's episode. We know I love Espoma. They're a family-owned and operated company dedicated to making safe indoor and outdoor gardening products for people, pets, and the planet. Plant friends, if you need gift ideas for the plant parent who has it all, maybe consider putting together an epic Espoma gift package. For the indoor plant enthusiast, you could wrap up some of their easy-to-use liquid indoor plant food, a variety of their indoor-focused potting mixes like their cactus mix, their African violet mix, or even their orchid or bonsai mix, and then top it off with a selection of their horticultural sprays. Or if there's an outdoor gardening enthusiast in your life, you could pair their famous Holytone plant food with maybe their BioStarter Plus, which is an essential for any beginning garden season, maybe a bag of their seed starting mix, which is amazing, and their organic land and sea compost. Whatever you're growing or whatever type of plant parent you're hanging out with, Espoma has a potting mix, compost, or tone for you. Not only are their products organic, but their manufacturing plant is solar powered, they have bio-preferred packaging and a whole line of pet-safe products, and they're family-owned and operated a business for over 90 years. They've been around. To learn more about all of their amazing indoor and outdoor gardening products that Espoma has to offer, visit Espoma.com to find your local Espoma dealer, or visit my Amazon storefront for a curated list of my favorite Espoma picks. Thank you, Modern Sprout, for sponsoring today's episode, one of our OG sponsors. They are on a mission to connect people and plants with their amazing assortment of grow lights and planty accessories. Plant friends, if you've listened to the show, you've definitely heard about my obsession with Modern Sprout. Whether it's been their Grow Bar and Grow House smart app-enabled grow lights, whether it's been their 3-liter watering can that I can't get enough of and talked a lot about in the gift guide, and their countless other planty accessories that make plant parenthood fun and easy. Whether you live in a studio apartment or a big old farmhouse, Modern Sprout truly offers simple, stylish, and sustainable green thumb solutions for every home. They really have something for everyone, whether you're an ultra beginner gardener or whether you're a plant enthusiast that's been around for a while, just looking to up your plant parenthood game or maybe the aesthetic of your plant parenthood accessories. So I first discovered Modern Sprout when I found their stylish and easy to assemble grow lights, and all of their grow lights are now smart app enabled. And it's so cool. You download the Modern Sprout app, and then the lights come with preset settings for partial shade, partial sun, or full sun. Or you can actually fully customize your lighting schedule for your plants. So when we had our grow shelf in our bedroom, which I created with the Modern Sprout Grow Bar, which is a flush mount white metal fixture that I installed in my bookshelf, I was able to customize the lighting schedule to my sleep schedule. So I would program the light to like fade out 30 minutes before I wanted to go to bed. They also have their Grow House, which is their beautiful brass planter for direct planting, along with hanging hardware so you can actually hang it on your wall and like maybe incorporate it into a gallery wall. Speaking of gallery wall, they actually have their smart grow frames, which are literal frames with grow lights embedded in them. So you can turn your plants into pieces of art by mounting them on the wall. So you might know Modern Sprout for their grow lights, but you also might know them for their indoor grow kits and candle kits, which is probably what they're most famous for. And I feel like they are the most giftable the holiday season. I'm obsessed with their candles. I've talked about them for several years. So let's talk about their indoor grow kits first. They come with everything you need to grow a variety of seeds, from their garden jars that are created for herbs. They also have terracottas and tiny terracottas to grow your own house plants from seed, like aloe and lavender. My favorite grow kits are their Glow and Grow and their rooted candle lines. The Glow and Grow specifically, you get a deliciously scented candle, you burn it out, and then it comes with growing media to start your own seeds, and the candle turns into a planter, and the scents are amazing. You have to check them out. So when you're shopping this holiday season, Modern Sprout seriously has something for everyone, and everything that they have comes in beautiful packaging, and they are committed to trying to reduce their use of plastics as well. They have an exclusive discount for listeners of 15% off with the code BLOOM21. So that's BLOOM21. I can't share all of their amazing products that they have with you in a 1-minute ad. So check out their website, modsprout.com, and use the code BLOOM21 at checkout for 15% off. It's linked in the show notes. I think that whole, and this is a whole nother conversation that we're going to have inside of the Garden Society, but the whole concept of seasons when it comes to houseplants and the growing season for a houseplant, when most of the time they're indoors, they're not experiencing the seasons, especially if you have them under grow lights that are, you know, are the same. That's a whole nother can of worms.
Totally. Well, it is. And we're going to actually, our first class in the Garden Society, I'm going to get into a lot of the core science about dormancy with many plants. And so, you know, spring is not going to be the time to repot a lot of species that you grow, because spring might be the time that they're flowering and you don't want to repot them when they're flowering, or that might be the period of time that they're dormant. And you take a dormant plant that has a really low respiration rate and you put it in a bigger pot with extra moisture, you're going to rot it. So species specific is always very important. Your particular environment, if your particular environment has a very low humidity and your plant is transpiring faster and you're finding you have to water constantly, then you may go up, right? You may need to just go ahead and pot that plant up. So certainly there are seasonal growth cycles for all sorts of different plants. Many of your tropical and subtropical houseplants, they don't have a dormancy season. They don't have, you know, they're going to continue to essentially grow as long as temperature and light is adequate. So you can repot those plants anytime they need repotting. Other species of plants, many succulents and geophytes, bulbs, tubers, things like that, will have more cyclical growth and dormancy cycles that really will dictate when you repot, not just the spring season.
Yeah. So it sounds like replacing the myth of repot your plant every 1 to 2 years with repot your plant when it's showing signs that it's ready to be repotted. And from what you've said, it sounds like to pot up, meaning actually pot it up in a pot 2 inches larger. And it is important to go only, you know, 2 inches larger instead of like a going from a 4 inch to like a 12 inch pot.
It will depend. I'm going to say that depends. For example, I have a little alocasia. I think it's Dark Star. I'm not even sure it came unlabeled. So, you know, trying to figure that's another whole point of contention that's got roots growing out of the pot. These are very large growing plants. They need a lot of water. It's in a little 4 inch pot right now. I'm going to bump that baby up to probably an 8 inch pot because I know how aggressive its root system is. I know that it is growing from a corm that's going to enlarge. And if I give it enough water, it's going to grow really fast. It's under grow lights. Even though we're going into winter, it's getting an extended day length from the grow lights I'm giving it. Now, if I had like a little peperomia or a African violet, right, that had roots growing through, say, a 2 inch pot, I'm probably only going to go up to a 3 inch size pot because that species has a small, delicate, less aggressive root zone. So you can say if you're bumping up to a larger size, a general recommendation of going up 2 to 4 inches in diameter is useful. However, you got to throw that out the window when you get down to the species level and the size of the plant.
And when you know enough. Yeah, when you know enough.
When you know enough.
Yeah.
Like once you know enough. So, you know, using that 2 inch rule, if I take that alocasia that I just mentioned, and I go only 2 inches, right, from a 4 inch to a 6 inch, I'm going to be repotting again in 6 months. Knowing more about the species you're growing and its seasonal cycles and really knowing what kind of root system it has, you repot when the plant actually needs it, not on the schedule the internet tells you to repot all your plants.
And when you know it needs it is, like you said, if their roots popping up out of the top of the pot, out of the hole in the bottom of the pot, if it can't get enough water because the roots are obviously just absorbing everything the minute you pour, probably if it's been a while and the plant is unhappy, if it's showing signs of distress, drooping. But yeah, like looking for the signs and paying attention to the plant and not the general prescription.
Inspecting the root zone. And so one of the things I try to teach people to do when they buy plants is pop that plant out of the pot and look at the root system. That's what you have to do with your plants at home. To understand whether or not that plant is really ready to repot it, you need to pop it out of its pot. You need to look at the root zone, especially for plants that could potentially be suffering from a pot that's too large, from growing media that's too wet, or from overwatering or low light. They're not going to have a huge root system that's pushing the plant out of the pot. They're going to have too small of a root system due to decay. And unless you pull that plant out of its pot, you're not necessarily going to know that until it's too late.
So another myth busted by Leslie Halleck. Okay, so myth number three is one that I've talked about a lot because this is something I used to suggest to people and this is something I used to practice and I no longer do after learning better, but the concept of misting and that everybody says misting is great for your plants and everybody should be misting all the time and that misting increases humidity. So can you bust some myths on that topic as well?
Yeah, this is a tricky one. And the whole understanding humidity and relative humidity and vapor pressure deficit, and you know, it's complicated. It all relates back to transpiration in the plant, right? How water moves from the growing media or the soil into the roots and up and out of the stomata of the plant. And that rate of transpiration depends on things like air temperature and the amount of humidity, water, vapor that's already in the air. And what's the difference between the amount of water that's inside that leaf and what's outside of that leaf? Because we know that water is going to move generally from areas of lower concentration, higher concentration to lower concentration. And as you know, we have warmer air and water molecules that are more excited, you know, they're going to transfer into that water vapor state more quickly, more readily, and your plant is going to lose water, right, faster. And each species, depending on where it's evolved, you know, has a range of humidity that's ideal, you know, for that plant, depending on circumstances. Some plants are very, very dependent on high levels of relative humidity, whilst other species are adapted to thrive in super low humidity, right? It just depends on where that plant is adapted to. Many of the plants we grow inside are tropical, subtropical foliage plants that are native to rainforest type conditions with anywhere from 70 to almost 100% relative humidity. Bring them inside a home where you can have anywhere from, you know, 10 to 20 to 50% humidity, and your plants are going to dry out faster. And some of those plants are not going to tolerate that condition. And so often the recommendation is, if you've got things like orchids or ferns or, you know, whatever it is, you get one of those cute little misters or a hand mister bottle and you mist the air around the plants. And that's going to create a higher humidity level for those plants to survive in. Unfortunately, you would probably have to stand there all day with your little mister bottle, misting the air around those plants continuously all day long to have any effect on meaningfully changing the humidity levels such that the transpiration rate of your plants slows down significantly. So I have lots of things to do in my day. I don't know about you, but standing there misting my plants all day is just not something that's going to happen. It's going to have little to no meaningful effect mm-hmm. on raising the humidity level in your space high enough, especially in warmer air, as we're going into the winter and people are kicking on their heaters, that warm air, right, can potentially hold a lot more water vapor. So it takes a lot more water vapor to get to a higher relative humidity to make plants happy. So they'll dry out faster when you kick those heaters on. So hand misting the air around your plants is relatively ineffective. And then that's a bummer because it's something that's fun to do. It makes us feel like we're doing something good for our plants. We all love the pretty little glass misters, but in an open air windowsill culture, that's not going to be totally effective. We can talk about situations where it is effective. And I can talk to you about what I consider misting to actually be, which is direct watering, and what plants might actually benefit from doing that. And then sort of my strategies for maintaining those high humidity plants instead of standing around hand misting them all day.
Yeah, totally. Let's talk about that. Because I think some people really do, like you said, enjoy their glass misters. I used to enjoy the act of misting my plants, which I no longer do. Now, if I feel the need to mist or the need to kind of engage with a plant, I'll mist my moss poles because they dry out so quickly that I could mist my moss poles every day. And, you know, they would still always need more water. It's interesting that you talk about misting the air around the plants instead of the leaves. So yeah, like let's dive in more for when misting is appropriate and when it isn't.
Right. So misting your plants, you know, technically means misting the air around it, right? You're trying to increase the humidity. A lot of people interpret that as I'm going to mist the water onto the foliage. So that's what a lot of people are actually doing. And if you are doing that, how I qualify that, like I talk about this in my book, Tiny Plants, what you're actually doing when you're spraying or misting water directly onto the foliage or the stems is, I mean, you're essentially watering that plant. You're not misting that plant. You're watering it, right? So if you have a plant that's epiphytic that produces aerial roots, or say maybe you're growing air plants, tillandsias, that are completely epiphytic that need that water on their foliage, essentially what you're doing is watering those plants. You're not really misting the air, you're watering them. And for some species of plants, that can be beneficial. You're not increasing the humidity in the air around them by doing that. You're actually putting water on the plant, on the stem, on the aerial roots. So really what a lot of people are doing when they think they're misting their plants is they're really watering them. And that can be good for certain plants and not so good for others, depending on conditions. So
what plants like it?
Right. So epiphytes, semi-epiphytes, high humidity plants that are reliant on getting most of their water from the air, right? Epiphytic orchids, vines with aerial roots, some ferns, bryophytes, mosses, liverworts, some carnivorous plants, things like that, that maybe don't rely on a large terrestrial root system. They're really relying on pulling that water, you know, from the air, you know, through their leaves or through their aerial roots. You know, those are the types of plants that are going to be happy. So if you have tillandsias, if you have air plants, you know, sort of a typical watering strategy is to just submerge them, just stick them in a bowl of water, right? And let them absorb water. If you misted a bunch of water onto that plant, you're essentially doing the same thing. You're watering it, right? That's what you're actually doing. If you say you have a bubble bowl planting, right? A glass vessel that's got an open top. We call those bubble bowls that will hold a little bit more humidity. Maybe you have some mosses in there. You can mist water onto those mosses. It helps trap a little bit more water vapor in those situations. But again, you're watering the plant. You're not misting the air necessarily or really making any meaningful change in the humidity around it. You're putting water directly onto the leaves and the roots. So plants that are by their nature high humidity lovers or epiphytes or semi-epiphytes, those are the kind of plants that are going to be happy, potentially, depending on circumstances with you, misting, spritzing water directly on them. Or if you have an enclosed environment, if you have a true terrarium that's planted and closed, a glass vessel that is planted and or has pots in it and is closed, you could mist into the air, into that vessel and close the lid. That will have an impact on humidity levels. But in open air culture, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, totally. So let's talk about when we shouldn't be misting, why we shouldn't be misting, what we shouldn't be misting.
Yeah. So certainly there are some dangers with spritzing, misting water directly onto plant leaves. Obviously, some plants are adapted to not have that kind of moisture. You know, if you've got plants with fuzzy leaves or succulents or cacti, you know, putting a lot of water on the foliage is not necessarily going to be helpful to them. They already have strategies for reducing transpiration and water loss, and you may be creating issues, right, of disease, fungal disease, bacterial disease. Same goes for tropicals. Same goes for ferns, depending on the circumstances or what spores are floating around. Water left sitting on the foliage, especially at cooler temperatures, is an opportunity for fungal and bacterial diseases to take hold. You see this very evident out in the garden, even just in high humidity without rainfall. If you've ever grown roses, black spot disease can go crazy. But certainly on ferns and many tropical houseplants, there are tons of fungal and bacterial diseases that can take your plants down. Heartleaf fern is a great example. Hemionitis. A lot of people struggle with this fern. It's a beautiful fern. And I know in my classes, I kind of use this as an example. This is a high humidity loving plant, but if you grow it out on the windowsill and you mist it, meaning you're getting water on the foliage, you often end up with just really unattractive, brown, mushy, rotting leaves. Take that plant instead and put it under glass. And don't mist it. Just put it under glass where humidity actually goes up. All of a sudden, you have a beautiful, happy plant. So simply spritzing water onto a high humidity loving plant isn't necessarily a recipe for success. African violets are a great example. In their natural habitat, African violets can be lithophytic. They can grow between rock crevices. They have a limited root system, but they might be growing in 90% relative humidity. But if you get water, if you mist an African violet and you get water on the foliage, what usually happens? You get marked phytotoxicity. Yeah. You can get contact, what's called contact phytotoxicity. So that water on that foliage can amplify irradiance, light, and burn the foliage, or you get fungal diseases, you get botrytis, you get powdery mildew or, you know, gray mold. So, you know, misting water onto the foliage of plants is not great. Now, I will say that, say on your Monstera deliciosa, which is a nomadic vine, or it might be called a semi-epiphyte. It's got aerial roots, right? Plants like these are susceptible in low humidity to get what? Spider mites. Spider mites thrive in low humidity. So you can potentially offset some of those conditions and make it inhospitable to things like spider mites by spraying some water onto the stems and foliage of those plants. But those are already epiphytic or semi-epiphytic plants that are adapted to that type of moisture exposure, right, on their foliage and on their aerial roots. Do that to, you know, your African violet all the time or you know, certain other succulents, and you're just going to end up with mush.
And I think the main takeaway is there are plants and times to mist, and there are plants and times not to mist. But in general, misting the plants is not the right way to increase the overall 24/7 humidity in your home.
So if you're running air conditioning in the summer, for example, you know, that air conditioner is going to be pulling moisture out of the air. So, you know, trying to spritz the air around your plants is not going to do any good. In the winter, and you're running heaters, it takes a lot more water vapor to raise the humidity in that warm air. So that's a losing battle. So what are some of the things we can do potentially to increase humidity around our plants without standing there with a hand mister? We can group plants together. That seems really simple, but when you group plants together, they're all transpiring, right? And they're releasing that water into the air. So you essentially create a little bit of higher humidity around your plants by grouping them together. That's a really lo-fi way to potentially increase humidity for plants that are in open air culture. And if you really, really need to increase the humidity, then you're probably better going to a humidifier, a powered humidifier. So like an evaporative or ultrasonic cool mist with a filter, preferably, that's got a long runtime that you can set next to a group of your high humidity plants and run that humidifier. Understanding that in summer, when you're running AC and you're putting a lot of water vapor into the air, you could make that AC work really hard. If you're doing that, I recommend you set your AC up a little bit higher because that water is going to cool things. The plants are going to cool things down. But in the winter, when you really have dry air in your house, the humidifiers can help. So that's also an option. Or you can grow high humidity plants under glass, which is what I do. And then I don't have to worry about any of that.
Yeah, you've totally gotten me on the growing under glass train for sure. When wanting to understand humidity, I feel like the biggest change for me in really understanding it was just going on Amazon. I have a YouTube video about it and just ordering some hygrometers. I don't know the right way to pronounce them. And just actually getting truly acquainted with what the humidity in my home was.
Yes.
And what I realized was the only way you're really going to make real change is getting a humidifier, you know, like,
right.
Especially if you have a big home. We were living in a loft. I mean, grouping plants together also is amazing. I do have to say, for our honeymoon, we just left for 2 weeks. I was nervous about my plants. I grouped them all together. And I put them on a tarp, grouped them all together. I didn't even do any of the weird, you know, watering hacks you see with like the string and a glass of water and whatever. I didn't do any of that. And I came back and my plants were so freaking happy. I mean, it's almost offensive, like how happy they were just being grouped together by my window, hanging out, enjoying each other's company and raising each other's, you know, relative humidity.
Yeah, that's usually one of the simplest things you could do. Now, if you're growing a very sensitive species, you know, that really does require higher humidity, you know, then you do have to go with the humidifiers or you go under glass. And I love using closed jars. I use kitchen canisters. If you have just an aquarium that's got a closed top, you can set potted plants inside. That's great. I know a ton of people have resorted to the IKEA glass cabinet grow because that's what they've realized is that, you know, trying to mist around these plants that have high humidity requirements doesn't work. You have to actually raise the humidity. And the only way that you can do that is enclosing the space and trapping that water vapor, right? Under glass or in a cabinet. And so that's what I tell folks is that if you're trying to grow really finicky, my little miniature Maranta, it stays under a glass cloche. Otherwise, I'm battling dried out leaf edges constantly, and no amount of me misting around that plant or even setting it on a gravel tray of water is going to effectively slow down transpiration enough to prevent that browning.
100%. I also experiencing going to Costa Rica for our honeymoon and experiencing what tropical humidity actually feels like versus my dry air. It was so eye-opening to actually like be in the jungle and feel what 80 to 90% humidity actually feels like versus what we subject our plants to on a daily basis.
It does speak to the resiliency of many of the plant species that we grow indoors that, you know, in situ, they're growing, you know, like you said, in almost, you know, anywhere from 80 to 100% humidity and with a constant availability to moisture. And then we take them out of that and we stick them in, you know, 30% humidity in a little pot. And,
We get mad at a little brown edge, you know?
Right. So, you know, one of the things I'm always going to encourage is that a collection of plants of different species really can't be managed the same way. You have to learn about the species that you're growing, the conditions in where it has evolved and where it naturally grows. And what do you need to do in your space to try to replicate that as much as possible? And so humidity indoors is a battle that you will typically lose. So grow the right species that will tolerate lower humidity, right, out in the open and on the windowsill, and skip the misting bottle. You can save the use of the misting bottle to add a little bit of humidity to enclosures like your IKEA case or a terrarium or a bubble bowl or a glass vessel that a plant isn't sitting inside. That will have efficacy, but out in your open space in your living area, forget about it.
So these were a couple of myths where you kind of were able to give us a little bit of insight into all of the science and all of the explanation and understanding that goes way beyond these little quips that we get on the internet. And like we alluded to in the beginning of the episode, that's why the Bloom and Grow Garden Society was founded. We have been working behind the scenes for, at this point, almost a year, building out a whole year's worth of amazing educational content that Leslie's coming on as our horticulturist in residence to bring an even deeper dive. This is like the 101, and we're bringing 201, 301, 401 level educational content. So I wanted to talk a little bit about, if you join our Garden Society, what you're going to get. When you join, you're going to get full access to everything that the Garden Party has to offer. And like we said, it's rooted in community. So you're going to get to connect with plant friends around the world, have all sorts of different conversation topics, the ability to find plant friends near you. And then you're going to get exclusive access to the Garden Society, which is a space within the Garden Party platform, where Leslie is going to be reigning supreme as our horticulturist in residence. And every month we've put together a really fun educational plan. So every month, Leslie is going to be giving a node of knowledge lecture. They're going to run between 60 to 90 minutes on really interesting deep dives on plant science topics. Leslie, do you want to talk about the first node of knowledge? Because I'm personally really excited for what you're going to put together for us.
Nodes of knowledge. I love it. So, you know, what we talked about today with this is just a scratch of the surface. So what we're going to do in the Garden Society is that there might be one physiological concept, whether it's talking about humidity or disease or plant growth. And I'm going to take a deep dive into that specific topic. You're going to get a class from me. You're going to get a lecture from me where I have taken a node, right, of interest of a plant science topic, and I fleshed that out into a class that I'm going to teach every month. And the first one we're starting out with, which I thought would be apropos since we're heading into the winter season, is the science of plant dormancy. Yes. And I know that many folks have a lot of questions, and there's a lot of misunderstanding about houseplant dormancy. There's a lot of myths out there about plant dormancy. And as more people get into collecting, you know, aeroids, there's a lot of confusion around that. And I will tell you that the science of plant dormancy is incredibly complicated. The biochemistry that goes into it is still being researched, and it's very complicated. But sort of what I do as a horticulture instructor, I'm a horticultural translator. That's sort of what I do. And so what I'm doing is I am taking all of my science knowledge, all of the information that's out there in the research, you know, publication world, and I'm going to digest that down for you so that it's understandable to you, so that you have a meaningful understanding of the actual basic science and what that means for your garden plants and your house plants. So you can be smart about your plants.
Yeah. And about dormancy in November. A lot of planty fake news about plant dormancy.
Yes.
And personally, yes, a lot of misunderstanding and just lack of understanding about the fact that I know some of my plants go dormant in the winter, and I know I'm supposed to like pare back watering, but I don't understand why or how. And I've definitely underwatered plants because of that. So I'm so excited about your first node of knowledge. But each month you get a different topic, and these nodes of knowledge live in this Garden Society section of the platform. So you can rewatch you have this educational hub, but you're able to call in live to these live lectures. So you'll be able to connect with your other society classmates. And at the end, there's even going to be opportunities to ask clarifying questions the way I do on the podcast, and maybe even engage with Leslie in that way. And another exciting offering about the Garden Society is we're also offering monthly AHAs, which is a riff on AMAs, which is Ask Me Anything, but it's going to be Ask Our Horticulturist Anything. And this is where that personal level of plant care and that diving deeper in a really personal way gets taken to the next level, because Leslie is basically going to have office hours where you can come with follow-up questions for the Nodes of Knowledge lectures. And maybe after listening and processing, you have another question about dormancy that you really want to work through with Leslie. You can go on those AHAs and ask that. Or maybe you have a personal issue with your plant collection that you can't figure out. You can talk to Leslie about your personal problem in this specific AHA that happens every month. And Leslie, I'm sure you're very excited to have a concentrated time to do this instead of just like throughout all of your DMs.
I can't on social media, right? How can I help everything? I don't have, you know, it's just not possible. So this is a classroom where I love to be. So every month, you're going to get that class, and it's going to be video and it's going to live in the platform, right? So you can go back and watch. There is also the discussion opportunities, right? The discussion boards and platforms that are in the Garden Society. So through that month, you can post questions there. People, you can interact with all of the other users. I will probably pop in as well and interact there, ask questions. And then we have our AHA. So you can come back in that month after going through that Node of Knowledge, ask questions, and then that's going to build up every month, right? Every month, I'm going to give another class. We're going to have other meetings. We're going to have resources that we post for you that are addendums to the Node of Knowledge for that month. And, you know, while we have built out, we have sort of a 12-month editorial calendar, education calendar, if you will, but we also want to get feedback. So I'm going to build classes a few months out, but we're going to be looking for your feedback. And if there's a topic that a lot of you really want me to dive into, and maybe I had another one planned and I have enough time, I'll do that class instead. So there is interactive opportunity for the users to have an influence on what we learn over the course of the year.
My heart explodes when I think about this, because there's so much opportunity for growth on so many different levels. Each individual who shows up to the Garden Society is going to grow, because they're going to show up to these lectures and just learn a little bit more every month about some sort of aspect of plant care. But they're also going to grow alongside their community, right? Other society members are going to be there in the class. You're going to be making those connections, coaching each other as well, helping each other along the way. So you grow as a cohort and you're going to grow as an individual plant parent. And then on my end of this, I'm really interested in the wellness aspect of plant care. I really believe that plants do make people happy and that plant care is self-care. So on top of the monthly Node lectures and AHAs, I'm also going to be hosting separate Growing Joy calls. And those are going to be Zoom calls that our community gets to get on together and explore the plant person connection in a different way, whether that's exploring some aspect of planty wellness, whether that's jamming on whatever plants are bringing us joy right now. But it's another opportunity for people to meet and grow deeper and grow together. And I think Leslie and I are really just lit up by the idea of helping people grow their collections, grow themselves, grow their knowledge, and just make the world a kinder and greener place.
I'm excited. And this is going to be, you know, we're going to dive into plant science topics that are relevant to houseplants, but also obviously your outdoor garden and nature. So I'm a comprehensive horticulturist, right? So we are going to hit a lot of different topics that are going to be useful to you, whether you are an indoor gardener only, an outdoor gardener only, or both. And I think a lot of the information will inspire you and empower you to maybe try new things you haven't tried before.
Absolutely. That's our goal, to get everyone curious and constantly growing and constantly experimenting within their collections and pushing themselves. So this is where we invite you guys to become founding members of the Garden Society. We launched today, Tuesday the 2nd, and we have an unbelievable offer running through November 9th. So it's 7 days for you to take an opportunity to get 25% off of your enrollment. And there is an option to enroll for the entire year and get 25% off of your entire year. On November 10th, the prices go up. So we are really excited to find this cohort of founding plant friends, founding Garden Society members, because like Leslie said, you are going to be who we turn to and survey and ask, what do you want to learn about? How do you want to grow? How can we help you continue on your plant parent journey? Because that's the whole mission of the Garden Party and platform and the Garden Society, is to help our community keep blooming and keep growing on the next level. So we offer you to click the link in the bio and come join us in the Garden Society. Come be plant nerds with Leslie. Come wax poetic about plants with me. All of the links and everything you need to know is in the show notes. So a year subscription to the Garden Society is less than one normal online course. And a monthly subscription to the Garden Society is less than a 10-inch plant. So if you think about that, for the cost of a 10-inch plant, you could be getting daily support from the other Garden Society plant friends, monthly support from Leslie, our horticulturist in residence, myth-busting galore, and wellness journey with me. So I feel like we're kind of the one-stop shop for plant parenthood growth. What do you feel like, Leslie?
I think this is the most amazing plant school that's ever yeah. happened. The cool thing about it from my perspective is, like you said, I can't spread myself thin over social media, nor can I just do that 24/7 for everybody who needs it. There's just not enough of me to go around. And so this is a concentrated, exclusive space where we get to learn together and one-on-one, and there's a community that we are supporting one another, right? So the community is supporting me to be there to do this work, because it is, it's a big investment of time and energy and work to do this teaching. And for me to be there directly to support the subscribers and the Bloom and Grow audience directly in a really meaningful way, it just is super exciting and it feels great to me. And I just think it's going to be a much more productive, empowering space. And that's where I would like to spend my time.
Yeah, me too. That's why we've been working behind the scenes on building this. So come join us. Click the link in the show notes. Leslie, thank you as always for joining us on the podcast and also delivering all of this really interesting free educational content today. And we can't wait to see you inside the Garden Society, plant friends.
Yeah, I'm so excited. As always, I'm happy to be on the podcast now and then, but now with the Garden Society, we're going to be having a lot of together time every month as we learn and grow.
Yay. All right. See you in the Garden Society. Okay, plant friends, there you have it. Leslie and I sincerely hope that you join the Garden Society. We're going to have so much fun in there. And also, when you're a founding member, we really are going to be turning to the founding members to help us build this platform. We have a content calendar of a year of educational stuff, but if you guys all tell us that you want an episode on something very specific, Leslie's happy to build educational content around that too. So we really want to work with our founding members to create the virtual Garden Society of their dreams. How freaking exciting. So all the links to join are in the show notes. The 25% discount ends November 9th, so make sure you snag that now. And with the pricing, we've really tried to price it. So, you know, the monthly price comes out to be around 6 to 8 inch plant. The annual price comes out to be less than a college level course and many online courses you might have taken in other varieties, because we're kind of first to market with this. So click the links. We can't wait to see you in the Garden Society. We hope the myth busting was helpful. And until next time, plant friends, keep blooming and keep growing. Plant friend, thank you for tuning in today. If you like what you heard, make sure you're subscribed to the show so you never miss an episode. And while you're there subscribing, why don't you click over to the review section and leave us a review? It would be tremendously helpful for the show, so thanks in advance. If you're looking for more planty content or ways to help and support the show or engage with our community, we've got a ton of options for you. So first, there's the free Bloom and Grow Plant Parent Personality Test. It is a super fun 3-minute test that I made for you that pairs you with your plant parent personality profile, where you'll learn your planty strengths and weaknesses and get a curated list of plants, projects, and podcast episodes that are right up your alley, tailored just for you. The test lives at Bloom and mangrowradio.com/personality. And you have to let me know what your results are on Instagram. You can find me on Instagram at Bloom and Grow Radio. If you're interested in supporting Bloom and Grow Radio, consider becoming a Patreon plant friend of the show. Patreon plant friends are members of the community who support the show monetarily on a monthly basis for as little as $4 a month. And these magical humans help support the show and bring our content to as many planty eyes and ears as possible. Once you join, you'll also get the secret password to our Facebook group, which I like to call the plantiest corner of the internet. We have a lot of fun over there. You can become a Patreon plant friend at patreon.com/bloomandgrowradio. And of course, you can also just join our newsletter that I like to call the Garden Club. When you join our Garden Club, you'll receive a free download of the exclusive Molly Mansfield Keep Blooming print, which is so adorable. And I'll slide into your inboxes, usually only around twice a month, with plant care tips, recent episodes, and announcements. You can join at bloomandgrowradio.com/community. And for anything else, plant friends, I'm here for you. So feel free to drop me a line when you have an idea for an episode, an event, or maybe even if you're a planty business interested in sponsoring the show. Thanks again for listening. It is my honor and delight to help you keep blooming and keep growing. Plant friends, propagate knowledge, and grow some freaking joy. That's the motto of the Growing Joy Garden Society app and platform, otherwise known as the plantiest and kindest corner of the internet. If you've been an OG listener or a longtime listener, you might also know this app and platform as the Bloom and Grow Garden Party, but with the rebrand, we've rebranded it to the Growing Joy Garden Society. No trolls allowed, kind plant friends only. And if you haven't heard about the society yet, Plant Friend, you got to join. It's my online community that you can access via iOS or Android app or on your computer that I built to connect our international community of plant friends so we can all nerd out together about plants and celebrate our passion for our beloved plant babies. We have members literally all over the world. I'm so in love with this community of sweet plant friends. I can't say enough amazing things about them. But also, there's a lot of really cool features about the app you might be interested in. There's dedicated hashtags to all sorts of different subsects of planty passions like houseplants, gardening, plant-inspired DIY projects, growing joy, plants and pets, and so many more. There's a plantrepreneur group. So if you're a planty entrepreneur and you want to connect with other planty entrepreneurs, you can join that group to connect and network. There's a plant swap section. Plus, the entire app, and this is my favorite part, is entirely searchable. So say you want to learn more about Hoya, you type the word Hoya into the search bar, and literally every post ever created about Hoya will pop up so you can click in, see what other people have been posting about Hoya and learn on your own and crowdsource hair information. It's so cool. But last but not least, it's an amazing way to support the show. Your monthly membership not only goes to sustaining the platform, but it also supports my team of editors, writers, and a community manager that help the world of Bloom and Grow keep growing. So come join us. All you got to do is go to jointhegardensociety.com and sign up for the community plan. Once again, you go to jointhegardensociety.com and click the community plan. Hot take, plant friends. There is no one right starter plant. There, I said it. And you know what? While I'm at it, there are also no real plant killers in the world. There are just people who have not figured out their right plants for their lifestyle. This is why I created the free Plant Parent Personality Test, because Plant Friend, I want you to get thriving alongside your houseplants as quickly as possible, so I made this cutie little Plant Parent Personality Quiz that's totally free for you on my website to take the guesswork out of building your plant collection effortlessly and joyfully. After speaking to thousands of members in our community, I realized that there are about 5 key plant parent personalities, each one with their unique set of strengths, weaknesses, and a unique set of plants that thrive under their care. For example, a mindful plant parent, someone who wants to engage with their plants daily, use them in their morning routines. If someone gifted that plant parent a succulent and they watered it every day, that succulent would die immediately. However, that drought-resistant succulent is a perfect match for a low-key plant parent, which is someone who travels, has kids, is busy, doesn't have time to engage with their plants every day. They're looking to engage with their plants more like once a week or once every couple of weeks. In addition, obviously, to understanding your light and basic plant care that we provide on this podcast, Happy Plant Parenthood is all about discovering your personality and then picking the right houseplants to go with it. It's that simple. No more stressing over your collection. So what plant parent personality type are you, plant friend? All you got to do to find out is take my free quiz on my website and let me know. You can access it at growingjoywithmaria.com/personality. After taking the test, you'll get an email with a list of plants, podcast episodes, and planty projects that I think would light you specifically up like a full spectrum grow light. So once again, that's growingjoywithmaria.com/personality for your free plant parent personality test results.